Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang, and this is episode number 188, part two of our two-part series. Our guest over these episodes is writer, historian, filmmaker, and genealogist Regina Mason. This, again, is a wonderful conversation, so thanks so much for joining us. Hi, everybody. Paul Vogelzang here. Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. Thanks for joining us today. Today's show is a great one. Again, our guest, Regina Mason, is a well-known international speaker, author, executive producer, and storyteller who believes in the extraordinary will of the human spirit. Regina Mason has spent 15 years researching the life and times of her great-great-great-grandfather, pioneering fugitive slave autobiographer, William Grimes. She has spent nearly a lifetime turning a negative into a positive that would one day culminate with a new edition of her ancestor's book, The Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave.
If those who read my history think I have not led a life of trial, I have failed to give a correct representation. I hope some will buy my books from charity, but I am no beggar. I am now entirely destitute of property. Where and how I shall live, I don't know. Where and how I shall die, I don't know, but I hope I may be prepared. If it were not for the stripes on my back, which were made while I was a slave, I would, in my will, leave my skin as a legacy to the government, desiring that it might be taken off and made into parchment, and then bind the Constitution of glorious, happy, and free America. Let the skin of an American slave bind the charter of American liberty. William Grimes.
That, of course, is our guest today, Regina Mason, reading from her great-great-great-grandfather's book, The Life of William Grimes, The Runaway Slave. Regina Mason currently serves as executive producer of the film documentary Gina's Journey, The Search for William Grimes, and is joining us today via Skype from Oakland, California. To catch up from part one, we're joined as Regina Mason describes William Grimes' purchase of his freedom from his slave master in 1825.
And to hopefully recoup some of the money that was lost
and that,
behind the sale, or behind, the sale of his home
and,
for his freedom.
And that's what he had to pay. He liquidated that asset in order to pay for his freedom. And so what was life like for him in New Haven? Did he work prior to this period of being recaptured? Did he have a profession? Was he always
he
on the run? And did he always have to look over his shoulder?
Yes, all of that. it was very hard to carve out a life for himself in New England. He was constantly cheated out of money or warned out of town because he was always having to compete with poor whites who thought that they deserved more and better than he did. But he had a profession. He was a barber by trade. And that was a black man's profession. White people were not barbers at that time. And so he would cut the hair of the governor. He worked about the colleges. And when I say the colleges, he was in New Haven at Yale College as a general servant to the students. But he also was a barber by profession in the back, what he called the back country of Litchfield. And that is where the Tapping Reeve Law School was, and that's the first law school in the history of this country where men, for the first time from the North and the South, would go to get educated in law. Prior to that, they had to go to England. And so you had the North and the South converging, and William Grimes was in the middle of all that in Litchfield. Litchfield was like a safe haven for William. New Haven was the bustling city, so to speak, where he was more likely to be spot it, and it was where Yale was, and you had the North and the South being educated there as well. So he was spotted by different people. Again, he had 10 different masters. So when Southerners went north, and they attended Yale College, and so again, he was spotted by some of his master's friends. So he retreated to Litchfield, where he thrived as a businessman, where he was able to buy property. And he not only bought property, but he bought a building where he had it moved onto his property, and where he lived and where his business was established. So he did well there until his master found him and demanded that he, you know, either purchase his freedom or to be brought back to Savannah in chains.
I think one of the powerful things about this story, too, is William Grimes' book and his writing predates some of the abolitionist history, and so William Grimes never had any white sponsorship in order to make his way north, right?
Absolutely. Well, he had no white sponsorship to assist him in writing this narrative. I learned from Bill Andrews that the famous fugitive slave or slave narratives of the 1840s and 50s that were trademark of the abolitionist movement and sponsored by white people. These narratives were even edited by white people and then promoted by white people. William Grimes had none of that. He wasn't writing for a white audience. Those other books were geared towards a white audience. He was out there on his own doing this, and this was 8 years before the anti-slavery society was formulated. This was before William Lloyd Garrison, the famous abolitionist, even publicly stated that what his position was. This is before his newspaper, The Liberator. It was before the first African American newspaper, Freedom's Journal. It was before Nat Turner's Rebellion. So when you peg it on a historical timeline, you see how pioneering this man's work was. He predates everything that speaks toward anti-slavery movement in the country, which is why it was never picked up by the abolitionist movement, because that spark hadn't really caught on and was this national entity that it developed into.
As you read this book, again, the life of William Grimes, the runaway slave, and you mentioned William Andrews and, of course, Regina Mason, you have edited this book, but you get this strong sense as to who William Grimes is and his strong sense of himself. This is really a story about human spirit, one now that you've made into a film, Gina's Journey, a documentary.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'll tell you how it all came about.
Mm-hmm,
I was at a book signing for my book with Dr. Andrews in Berkeley, California, right across from UC Berkeley, where I worked for many, many years. And I invited a number of people, and Sean Durant was one. And I didn't know at the time he was an up-and-coming filmmaker. I didn't know much about his work in film, but I knew that he had some sort of background that connected to MTV and music videos and things like that. Well, his wife is cousin to my husband. And so Sean and his wife, Tamala, were in the audience. And afterwards, he came to me and he said, you know, Gina, you've uncovered a lot of information. It's such a compelling story. You should put visuals to it. And my thought was, well, okay, it sounds great, but how are we going to do that? And we met over time. I didn't agree to it right away because I didn't know Sean's background. But little by little, he convinced me that we could do this. And I agreed. I said, you know what, I know that film is the best way to reach, if not global audience. And I knew that the book would only have some traction because it's more academic than mainstream. So back in 2009, we decided, okay, we're going to make this happen. We had no money. we didn't know how we were going to get it done, but we had a lot of faith. And so we put together a little trailer that eventually morphed 5 or 6 different times into something different. We didn't know quite how we were going to tell the story, whether or not it was going to be the traditional documentary style or docudrama or what have you. So it kept growing. And once we did crowdfunding, our first one was Kickstarter, and we had, I think we wanted to raise like $35,000. Well, we felt short, and we raised $20,000. So we quickly had the idea to have our supporters redirect their funds to us. Because Kickstarter was an all-or-nothing endeavor. If you didn't raise all the money, you got zero. But we were smart enough to realize that we needed the support. And if people were supporting us like this at $20,000, perhaps they would redirect their funds, which they did do. We didn't recoup all $20,000, but enough to put together a wonderful trailer to gain traction.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that, and we had fundraisers, and every time we got money, we went out and shot a portion of the movie. And we did this like 4 different times until we ended up with a full movie. We had people come out of the woodwork saying, you know, this is a great story. I've got some experience in this part of filmmaking. This is what I can offer. So the community made this movie. The community made it happen, and we followed William Grimes' example by giving ourselves permission, feeling that we were fully equipped with what we had at the moment to make this film. We knew we didn't have to have all the answers, that in time they would come to us, and that's essentially how it happened. And William Grimes was our example. So now, fast forward 7 years, we've got this film, and as of 2017, we entered into several film festivals, and we received 6 different laurels and 1 award from the Oakland International Film Festival, where we received the Roots Award, and it just was so compelling because we had no idea when we started where we were going to end up. And to have this movie well received by the public, where we get standing ovations wherever we go, it just moved us to tears, actually, because we knew that it was a quote-unquote noble endeavor, but we did not know what the outpouring of... We didn't know that we would have such an outpouring of love for this film, and that has been our journey thus far. So now what we want to do is we want to get it on a network, and after that we would, you know, love to have it streamed, where people can, you know, watch it through entities like Netflix or something like that. and then we want to distribute it by DVD where everyone can purchase it. So that's our goal. That's
good.
Our goal.
Well, congratulations, of course, on the awards. It is a great story. I think these kinds of stories often are enhanced greatly by visuals. And I've heard you talk about the visual, actually, of William Grimes himself. That visual shows up on the cover of the book. And maybe talk about that, too, because that was really an interesting path that led you ultimately to discover that particular image of William Grimes.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Let me tell you, and I need to make sure that the audience is aware of this, but William Grimes actually published twice in his life.
Mm-hmm.
First in 1825. And that book is at the Beinecke Library at Yale. And to see that, to something so old, to have my ancestor's name on the cover, mm-hmm. It's just so moving. So absolutely moving. And of course, that is before the time of where images or daguerreotypes or whatever. There was no image of Grimes on that first book. But he republishes his book in 1855, and by this time he's an old man. And I, in my research, realized that there were two narratives out there. I didn't know where to find them, so I just started calling around in New Haven. I thought that was the right thing to do because that's where he wrote his story. And so I called, at the time, the New Haven Colony Historical Society, their Whitney Library, and a gentleman by the name of James Campbell, who was at the time the curator there, but he has since retired. He picked up the phone, and I asked him, did he have the second edition of the Grimes narrative called Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave, brought down to the present? And he said, well, let me check. And I'm on hold for what seemed like an eternity, but it really wasn't. And he came back, he said, well, yes, we do have the book. And it is preserved very well, and even the image is preserved. And I literally, I was tongue-tied and almost dropped the phone because I was sure that I would never know what this man looked like. But when he told me there was an image, I thought, oh, my God. I said, well, he's my great-great-great-grandfather. I didn't know there was an image. Is there any way that you could make a copy and send it to me? And he said, well, sure, we can do that. He said it would be best to have it in color, but we don't have a color copier. This is like 1998. And he said, but you know what? I said, look, if you could take it to a place where they have a color copier, you know, I'll pay for it, whatever the price is. And he kind of chuckled. He says, I'm sure we can handle this for you. And about a week later, I get this image of this man in the mail. And it is so moving. He's got this stovepipe hat on, like Abraham Lincoln. He's dressed very well, but he's holding this basket. And I don't know what this basket, what it was, what it represented. And it was quite curious to me. And he's got this piercing look in his eyes and almost as if to say, you've got to know my story. It just spoke to me. This image spoke to me. And just absolutely, it was amazing.
It is amazing. It is an amazing image. I noticed it immediately, and I agree with you. It just has this power and this sense of self. And I can tell, in talking to you, and I've talked to you a couple of times now, of course, but I can tell what this has meant to you and what it's meant to your family this wonderful story of perseverance and thriving, and these are kind of what we live for, really, in genealogy. And so what advice would you give to our listeners who want to find their ancestors and they want to delve back into oral history? They want to learn more. You mentioned earlier in our conversation today about talking to your seniors. Tell us about what that word means to you and how that kind of fits in with oral history, and then some advice.
Oral history is so important. You've got to know your family story. And oftentimes those oral histories have been distorted over the years. You know, you'll find threads of truth in them. But those are your first clues into your journey. And it's important to speak to the elders in the family because they're the closest to the stories. Mm-hmm. So to have a dialogue with your grandparents, you know, your elder aunts and uncles that are maybe a couple generations away from you, because they are closest to the story. You want to get a good sense of where your family came from. I would start with, of course, one family line first, whether it's maternal or paternal. I would work with the strongest oral story, because the more information you have, the easier it is to redo the research. Know your family's surnames. If you've got any family heirlooms or treasures, like an autograph book or a family Bible, ask those questions, because a lot of times the seniors will not offer any sort of information until you ask them. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. We can go to family parties at Christmas or Thanksgiving or what have you, and the seniors, you'll find them sitting alone quite a bit, mm-hmm. or maybe they're not, their hearing isn't where it should be, so they often don't contribute to the conversations. But that's the time when you have your relative there. That's the time you should be asking them questions. They should be front and center. They should be the center of attention, actually, because the more you get them to talk about themselves and their life in the family history, they feel engaged, they feel important, and they're sharing nuggets with you. So it is important to gather the basic information, and you start with yourself, too, when it comes to the records. Get your own birth certificate. Then follow your parents, get their birth certificates, because every document is going to reveal a clue to help you move back in time one step at a time. And there are so many there's so many things out there, databases, you know, we live in a digital age. There's Ancestry.com, there's a genealogy bank where you can gather old newspapers. I mean, there's no excuse in this day and age. One of the first things that I would tell people to do is get with a genealogical society in your community. They will be a wealth of information to you. They'll tell you where to go, how to go about doing. They often give free classes on how to construct your genealogy, the first steps, and so forth. So you're not alone. When I started, there was no African American Genealogical Society in my community. There was organizations back east, but I was too far away from that. So I really had to go it alone. The Family History Center at the Mormon Temple was a wealth of information. And if you've got a family history organization through the Mormon Temple in your community, that is your first archive that you want to go to. And essentially, you can find data first on Ancestry.com. But you want to be surrounded by people that know the process, people that can steer you in the right direction. So that's critical in this day and age, and such, so important.
Such great advice and such a wonderful story. Regina Mason has been our guest today. She, along with William Andrews, have edited the book Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave. Regina Mason, we're going to keep this story going, of course, with you, but we also want to help with the movie. Personally, I am excited to see this movie. We're looking forward to talking to you again, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And if anyone wants to read the slave narrative, Life of William Grimes, the Runaway Slave, or connect with the movie Gina's Journey, The Search for William Grimes, please go to our website at www.ginasjourney.com.
ginasjourney.com. We're going to put links up to Regina Mason's work, where you can find more information about William Grimes, where you can find information about the movie, ginasjourney.com. We'll put all of that on the website. But Regina Mason, thank you so much again for joining us. What a fascinating story.
Paul, thank you so much. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you.